Good evening. It's wonderful to see everyone out tonight. If you're in the first and second Peter and Jude class, you heard Brigham reference early on in that class an idea that I want to explore a little bit more today. He kind of mentioned it in passing, but I want to look at it in a little bit more detail. One thing Brigham's really good at is planting these little seeds of things that you might want to go explore a little bit more. And this was definitely one of them. In 1 Peter, from the start, Peter addresses his audience, and he's addressing them as people who ought to look of themselves as aliens, as these foreigners, as these sojourners, people who are not in a land that they're supposed to be in. And he wants his audience, as Brigham put it, to look of themselves as immigrants, people who are different from the world around them. People who are tightly knit together, people who work, but they do so looking to go back home, people who don't assimilate with the culture around them, but attempt to keep their behavior true to their real home. That's what Peter wants his audience to think of themselves as, to be people who, despite this very difficult situation of being these persecuted sojourners, I want you to rise above those difficulties in a godly manner. And the way in which Peter tries to get this message across is he makes a lot of references to the Old Testament. He makes a lot of references to Abraham and Moses. Not only are these two individuals pinnacles of faith, but they're individuals who proved their faith in the way that they sojourned, in the way that they followed God in the middle of that. He quotes on the prophet Isaiah. Isaiah warned Judah of becoming aliens or exiles themselves, but he also prophesied to them while they were exiles. And among other references, he references a specific time in David's life. I understand a lot of people, a lot of young people here are studying the life of David. Well, if you really pay attention to this lesson, you might impress your teacher 2 or 3 weeks from now. We're going to take a look at a picture in David's life. When David was an alien, when he was a refugee, when he was on the run, how did David act? 1 Peter 3, he quotes from Psalm 34. And immediately after that quote, he references Psalm 56. And what's interesting about those two psalms is they are two of only 13 psalms that are given a historical context right before the psalm actually begins. And these two historical contexts are the exact same thing. Both of these psalms are written at the same with the same moment in mind, which takes place, as I have on the screen there, 1 Samuel 21. So you can go ahead and turn there if you like. But before we actually look at that story in 1 Samuel 21, I think it's important to briefly look at how we even got there. How did David get to 1 Samuel 21? Well, I think an appropriate place to begin is in 1 Samuel 17. And in 1 Samuel 17, you just kind of go over there and you skim and you look at that text, you see a story that pretty much everyone in the world is aware of. Maybe the most famous story in all of the Bible, David killing Goliath. I mean, it's so famous, at least in American culture, that it's become an idiom of sorts of an underdog story. Sports writers from everywhere write about it was a true David and Goliath story without having any idea as to what the story actually is. But they reference this story. And it's a great one to look back at. Because it's a story that displays wonderful faith on the part of David. In 1 Samuel 17, verse 37, David says, "The Lord delivered me from the paw of the lion, from the paw of the bear. He will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." There is such confidence in David because he knew of what God had done before. Well, God delivered me from the lion. He delivered me from the bear. So I know he's going to deliver me in this situation. You see such great faith on the part of David. This story is also great because of the faithfulness of God. God delivers David through pretty unconventional means, a slingshot and a stone. Well, in 1 Samuel 18, soon after this event takes place, things are going pretty well for David in that all the women of Israel are singing these great songs about David, singing these songs about how David is pretty much better than their king, Saul. Look at all these great things that David has done. And of course, this makes Saul pretty jealous. So jealous, in fact, that he ends up, while David is away, ends up giving David's fiance away to another man, and then he seeks to kill him. Which is what brings us to 1 Samuel 21. David's on the run. David is in fear of his life because the king, the most powerful man in the nation, is out to kill him. And so to bring us back to that imagery that Peter is calling his audience to think of himself, David is now an alien. David is this foreigner, this sojourner. However, rather than proving his faith through this difficult situation, rather than proving his faith through these trials, to use the language of 1 Peter 1, David relies on his own wit, his own smarts to deliver him in this situation. And as he does so, we get a series of mistakes on David's part in 1 Samuel 21. Again, if you're not already open there, go ahead and look at 1 Samuel chapter 21. Right from the start, it says that then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech came to meet David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one with you?" Verse 2, David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has commissioned me with a matter. And he has said to me, let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you. And I have directed the young men to a certain place." David flees to this place. This priest is terrified of why David is by himself. And he tells him, "Well, I'm on a secret mission from the king." Right off the bat, David lies. In some form of protection, he has thought of himself that this would be a good thing to do. Let me lie to the king as far as what my situation is. And then immediately after that, David gets hungry. He asks the priest for some food. The priest gives him some of the consecrated bread, which if you look at Matthew chapter 12 and verse 4, we won't get into the context of what Jesus is bringing up there. But Jesus straight up says that David went against the law. David did not obey the law in this situation. So in this dire situation, he relies on his own wit, he relies on lying, and he relies on going against God's law. But it continues. His lie continues in verse 8. He says that he left so quickly that he forgot to bring a sword. He didn't have time to grab a sword. "So Ahimelech, do you have a sword for me?" So he continues this lie. And Ahimelech gives David the sword, the only sword he had, which was the sword of Goliath. And I imagine, as David looks at this sword, his eyes get wide. And then he says, "There is none like it. Give it to me." It would seem as though David is relying on the sword. Specifically, though, this great sword of Goliath. He's searching for protection through this sword. And it's with this sword in hand that in verse 8, where is David going? David runs again, and this time to the king of the Philistines. David runs away to the king of the Philistines, Achish, or Abimelech, as Psalm 34 calls him. I want to pause real quick. That name, Abimelech, similar to Caesar or similar to Pharaoh, something like that. It would have been a name that was kind of passed down from one person to another, more a title than anything. So that might explain the discrepancy between those two names there. But David runs away to these Philistines. And so as David is distressed by these various trials, to use the language again of 1 Peter 1, David lies, he violates God's law, he trusts in the sword of Goliath, and then you see him seeking refuge in the Philistines. Who are the Philistines? He is now at the mercy of God's enemies, the enemies of God's people. These are people that Israel was constantly at war with. These are people that taunted the armies of the Lord. These are the people that David was so offended by before, back in chapter 17, that he has to stand up and defend God. But now, he must hope in their help. But of course, help doesn't come. Interestingly enough, the servants of Achish remind the king, "Hey, I remember this guy. Wasn't this the same guy that killed Goliath? Wasn't this the same guy that all those women of Israel were singing all those songs about?" He reminds the king of that. David hears of this, and now here he is again in fear of his life. David is afraid. And at his total wit's end, he starts acting like a crazy person. He fakes madness before the king. He's got drool running down his face, so much so that it's dripping through his beard. He's scratching on the walls. He's writing on the doors. And you see this pitiful, pitiful picture of someone who is in just total desperation and at his total wit's end. Can you relate to this story? I mean, I'm going to guess you haven't acted like a crazy person. I'm guessing. But maybe you've seen yourself in a situation like this, right? Maybe you felt threatened by somebody in either a literal or figurative sense, and you felt as though you were on the run. You relied on your own wit to get you out of a situation like that. I think we can all relate to David in this situation. Have you ever lied to try and protect yourself? Are you in the middle of a lie right now? Maybe with someone even in this room. I want you to notice what that lie did for David. As it always does, that one lie demanded more lies on the part of David. What began as this secret mission to the king ended up him lying about the need of a sword. He wasn't able to tell one lie and then go back to the truth. No, that one lie demanded that he tell other lies. And that's always how lies work. We shouldn't be surprised about that. So when David was in this difficult situation, he resorted to lying. Have you ever justified disobeying God for the sake of self-preservation? Some people are in some pretty dire circumstances. Some people are literally in this self-preservation mode in some way, in the way that David was. However, I think for most of us here, I use that word self-preservation figuratively. That really what we are trying to preserve within ourselves is some sort of sense of self, some sort of image, our status, our job, our happiness, maybe most especially our happiness, that we act out of a way to preserve that. That we start doing things that we shouldn't just for that sake. But maybe it's not that we're disobeying God's word per se. Maybe it's that we're doing things that are kind of on the edge, that maybe they're not wrong in and of themselves. They're kind of just these things that we do. Maybe it's that, well, you missed a service here or there. Or maybe it's that we are, we're participating in some particular act. It could be debated whether it's wrong or right. Well, I'm not here to debate whether that something is wrong or right. What I want you to think is, are you acting out of obedience to God's law, out of your best attempt at obeying God's law? Or are you acting out of self-preservation? Because I think there's a difference there. Have you ever trusted in worldly solutions to problems like David has done? Maybe it's trusting in violence, whether that's physical or whether that's verbal to solve problems. Have you ever done that? Maybe that's diligently searching for loopholes in tax laws just so we can help protect our financial situations. Maybe that's trusting in the government and actively pushing plans of one person or party to solve problems that really can only be solved in the heart. Have you ever run to worldly people to solve spiritual problems? I'm not saying worldly people can't make good financial advisors or therapists or coaches, but we got to monitor the counsel that we're seeking. David had a real problem in his life. David was running away for his life from Saul. But it seems as though David was just running to whomever would solve his most immediate problem, while totally disregarding the problems that this may cause. Like, David, did you not realize that you were running to the enemy? Did you not realize that you were running to the nation which you killed, their strongest person? You don't think that's going to cause some problems for you? Not only that, he disregards the fact that these people have no interest in God. These people have no interest in the things that God is about, like honor and compassion and mercy, things that David desperately needs in this situation. But no, he searches to solve that most immediate problem. Well, I want us to look at Psalm 56. I'm going to have it on the board here. I want us to look at Psalm 56. Because Psalm 56 tells us that this was written when David was taken by the Philistines in Gath. So again, this the context of this particular psalm is the story that we just talked about. Now, I don't think that this means that David wrote this psalm while he was in some Philistine holding cell or something like that. However, I do think that David is reflecting on this time immediately following this final act of desperation. Before he is actually set free, David is thinking about what's just happened. David pauses and he cries out to God for help. There's three things that we see within this psalm. And the first thing is that David opens the psalm by expressing his trials before God. He says, "Be gracious to me, O God, for man is trampled upon me. Fighting all day long, he oppresses me. My foes have trampled upon me all day long, for they are many who fight proudly against me. All day long, they distort my words," verse 5. "All their thoughts are against me for evil. They attack, they lurk, they watch my steps as they have waited to take my life." You notice that repeating phrase, verse 1, verse 2, verse 5. All day long this is happening. This is not just a one-time thing. You get the sense of this anxiety that is over David as he's constantly looking over his shoulder for protection. You know what? This would have been true if he was just running away from Saul, but it's made especially true in the situation that he is in at the hands of the Philistines. But I think it's important that as David reflects, even in the midst of these great trials, David is now able to soberly think about who God is. He is able to soberly think about what God has done before, something that he should have done long before. He reflects on God's goodness. Look at verse 8. "You have taken account of my wanderings. Put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? Then my enemies will turn back in the day when I call. This I know, that God is for me." I love verse 8. I love the imagery that's there. God is so aware of David's struggles that it is as if he has collected every single tear that has come from as a result of those struggles. Talk about a personal and intimate God. David is aware of that. When he is in this terrible, terrible situation that he has put himself in, he is able to reflect, "All of my tears, God knows. God is aware that I have struggled." And then because of this sober realization, David makes some declarations. Verse 3, "When I am afraid, I will put my trust in you. In God, whose word I praise, in God I have put my trust. I shall not be afraid. What can mere man do to me?" Then looking over at verse 11, "In God I have put my trust. I shall not be afraid. What can man do to me?" You get that repeated phrase, "What can man do to me?" That word "man," it can also be translated flesh. Some of your versions might read flesh. What can the flesh do to me? In one sense, you can read this as David reflects on all of his enemies. What can David's enemies actually do to him when he is in the comforting hands of the Lord? And perhaps that is the intended meaning, considering, well, every single version renders it that way. But also, considering he says, "I shall not be afraid." But I do want to put this out there. That prepositional phrase that is translated "to me," and I'm afraid I've lost about everyone in here but Mason. But that prepositional phrase "to me" is actually literally just the pronoun "me" or "I." So you could read it, "What can man," or "What can flesh do me?" So while "to me" is certainly an appropriate way to render this verse, I don't think it's much of a stretch to also read this, "What can man," or "What can flesh do for me?" Reflect on David's life at this point. Think about what he's done. David has been relying on his own wit, his own craftiness to solve his problems. And as he sits here waiting on the judgment of the Philistines, he finally realizes to himself, "Man, what has flesh done for me? What have I done for myself? If nothing else, it's only made things worse for me. What can man do for me?" Verse 13 says, "For you have delivered my soul," not me. "You have delivered my soul from death." It wasn't David's wit, but God alone. And I imagine David reflecting back on his showdown with Goliath. But now, it was God that delivered me from Goliath. In the same way that it was God that delivered me from the lion. It was God that delivered me from the bear. Peter puts it this way in 1 Peter 3 and verse 13. I think a direct reference here to Psalm 56. He said, "Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good?" So as we consider ourselves when we are in our own desperate situations, what can man do for me? I want to look at Psalm 34 as well. If you remember, I said earlier that both of these psalms have the same historical context. But the tone is very much different between these two. The heading of Psalm 34 tells us that this was after David's faked madness before the king, perhaps having had some time to reflect on the deliverance that God has given him. But while Psalm 56 does speak in confidence that God will deliver, Psalm 34 speaks much more triumphantly, much more deliberately about how God has delivered. And so perhaps a reference to Psalm 56, Psalm 34 and verse 4 says, "I sought the Lord and He answered me and delivered me from all my fears." So now David has had some time to reflect on this moment in his life when God delivered him. And this psalm has many of the same topics brought up as Psalm 56. But again, there's a notable difference in tone that I want to look at. He again lays out his difficulties. It's a longer psalm, so I won't have it all on the board. But he lays out his difficulties, but this time he speaks more in a general sense. He talks about the poor man who cries, the righteous cry, the brokenhearted, the crushed in spirit, the afflictions. But I want you to notice, this time around, he doesn't really dwell on those things. You notice that he only brings up the poor, the righteous, the brokenhearted, the crushed, to only talk about God's goodness. The poor man cried, and the Lord heard him. The righteous cry, and the Lord hears and delivers them. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. Why is David able to reflect so much on God's goodness? Well, I think it has a lot to do with what it says in verse 8. "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good." Did David deserve to be delivered from the Philistines? I mean, he ran straight into their arms, and yet God still delivers him. David is a man after God's own heart, because he is able to reflect on his mistakes, and he is able to see, "The Lord has delivered me every single time." Now, I want you to look at just all the blue that's there. It's a whole lot more than it was in Psalm 56. He is able to reflect more and more on God's goodness. And perhaps this recognition, like before, leads him to make similar declarations. Beginning of verse 1, he says, "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul will make its boast in the Lord. The humble will hear it and rejoice. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. And let us exalt His name together." You notice in Psalm 56, that repeated phrase over and over was "at all times." The enemies were constantly at me, at all times. But I want you to look at how David uses it here. "I will bless the Lord at all times." Regardless of whether I'm being persecuted, regardless of whether I'm in these difficult situations, now his trust is in the Lord at all times. I want us to keep in mind, again, the historical context of both of these psalms, Psalm 56 and Psalm 34. You don't need to turn over there, but in the very next chapter of 1 Samuel, so 1 Samuel 22 now, in those first two verses, David is delivered, he leaves Gath, and we're told that David is once again surrounded by a group of people. And it's interesting the description that's given to this group of people. It says in verse 2, the people who are around him, "Everyone who is in distress, everyone who is in debt, and everyone who is discontented gathered around him." Now, I can't prove this. But Psalm 34, specifically beginning in verse 11, and really you could argue most of the psalm, he seems to be speaking to a group of people. And it's as if in verse 11 he turns to this group that is mentioned in 1 Samuel 22. This group that is distressed, that is in debt, that is discontented, this generally disgruntled people, he turns to them and he gives them some advice. He says in verse 11, "Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." You want to know what it means to fear the Lord? You want to know what that looks like? "Who is the man who desires life and loves length of days that he may see good?" You want to know how that happens? "Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it." Essentially what David's telling them, don't do what I did. Think back on David's mistakes. Think back of what he did in 1 Samuel 21. Imagine David saying, "Look, I lied. I did not keep my tongue from evil. I actually spoke deceit to a priest. I lied to him. And I didn't depart from evil. Actually, I ran straight to evil. I ran to the enemy. I did not do good. I went away from who is good. I went away from God. I went away from His Word. I didn't do good. And I didn't seek peace. I actually put trust in a sword." Imagine David pleading with these people, saying, "Don't do what I have done." And so, as we reflect on it, I hope we see that truly trusting in God means not trusting in the things of the world. He says in 34 and verse 19, "Many are the afflictions of the righteous." That isn't to say that the righteous won't go through some difficult times. We will especially go through difficult times. The New Testament makes that very clear. But David's conclusion was, "But the Lord will deliver him out of them all." So again, what can man do for me? Peter quotes this very text that I have on the screen, specifically verses 12 through 14, in 1 Peter chapter 3. And like Peter's audience, we too should see ourselves as refugees in some way, as immigrants, as sojourners. And with that comes some difficulties. And I'm sure many reading Peter's letter felt like that band of 400 that's gathered around David in 1 Samuel 22. They felt distressed. They felt indebted. They felt discontent. And I'm sure many of you feel the exact same way. And it's understandable. It's expected even given the situations in life some of y'all are in. However, what's our response going to be? Will we seek our own deliverance, like David in 1 Samuel 21? Or will we learn from his example and begin with his conclusion? What can man do for me? I'm sure there's many out here today that need a fresh start as David was given. And you know what? If you need to confess some sort of sin and you feel the need to make that public, we can make that happen. You can come up to the front. You can sit up here. You can talk to someone. We can pray for you right now. We can pray some of the same prayers that David is praying here. We can make that happen. Or if you want to just kind of internalize this, think to yourself of what you need to do. I do encourage you to speak to someone, though, if there's something that you need to do. But I want to specifically address those who are not Christians and maybe are considering it. I want to address those who are contemplating, what can God do for me? Well, I hope what we see in David's life, and God is the only one who can do anything of value for you. Man can't do anything. God is the one who provides that good, specifically through His Son, Jesus. Now, we haven't talked about Jesus a lot tonight. There's actually a separate study that you can go through Psalm 56 and Psalm 34 and look how Jesus is all throughout those Psalms. Jesus is how God takes care of the righteous. You can be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins and you can walk with Him. There is nothing in ourselves that deserves something like that. But in God's goodness, He saw it fit to give us Jesus. If you have any need of either one of those invitations, I pray that you'll come up now while we stand and while we sing.